Welcome to another episode of Counsel for the State. I'm Idaho Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Counsel for the State is a podcast produced by my office. Our goal with each episode is to shed a little more light on the office, Idaho law, and other aspects of state government. By doing so, we hope to increase transparency and further your understanding. Thank you for listening, and remember, all of our past episodes are available at ag.idaho.gov. Here's Counsel for the State host, Scott Graff.
Welcome to Counsel for the State. Today, we welcome in a criminal investigator with the office's Internet Crimes Against Children unit. As you may recall, the ICAT commander, Chris McCormick, was a guest on Counsel for the State several weeks ago. And one of the topics discussed in that episode of the podcast was the increase in tips to ICAC since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. Currently, ICAC has about 1,200 cases that have been referred to it that are in the queue. With limited staff and the fact that these cases can often take months to investigate, ICAC has embarked on a training program to share its specialized skills with other law enforcement offices across the state. And one of the people responsible for establishing and conducting that program is Tamara Pitts. And Tamara is with us now on Counsel for the State. Tamara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And normally you would be hearing Brian Kane's voice about this point. Brian is actually very busy today. We needed to get this podcast knocked out. Brian is talking reapportionment here in the Capitol and could not be with us, but will join us on our next episode of Counsel for the State. So Tamara, before we dive in and talk about the training program that you have helped establish, let's get to know you a little bit. You are a criminal investigator in the AG's ICAC unit. Tell us what it is that keeps you busy. What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Typically, my day is we receive reports from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and those reports are involving possible accounts that may contain child pornography within them. National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC, receives their information from either citizens who call in and report this or from electronic service providers such as Facebook or Snapchat or Twitter or Kik. And those electronic service providers identify potential accounts that may have child pornography in them or that are transmitting child pornography, and they file those reports with NCMEC. And so then we get those reports, and we investigate those accounts and try to identify who the user is that may be possessing or transmitting that child pornography.
And that's the national center that all of these tips come into, and then that center essentially funnels these out to the various ICAC units across the country. And that 1,200 tips in the queue that we mentioned in our introduction, that's this report, these reports that come from NCMEC.
That is correct. Okay. That's where those tips come from, and that's how we get them.
Okay. So I mentioned this is a specialized set of skills that you folks have because these cases are different, and I understand first and foremost we need to protect the integrity of the type of investigation, the way that you investigate, but can you give our audience some indication of once that report comes in and someone like you begins to take a closer look, what are the next steps?
Some of the initial steps we do, obviously, we try to figure out who might be that user by looking for subscriber information of those accounts or looking to see what internet account might have been used to access those accounts or transmit that child pornography. We also try to figure out what else may be in those accounts. And so we get legal processes from the courts and from judges to look at the content within those accounts that are reported. If we identify a potential suspect or user of that account, then the next step is to identify additional information about that person and then potentially get a search warrant to seize any devices that person may have that may contain child pornography on them.
Okay. And that typically is the point where you get hands-on with the equipment. If you find it, that produces an arrest that leads to a prosecution, correct?
Correct. Okay. So when we make contact, we obviously try to interview the person we've identified to be the account holder. We would want to talk to other people in the home as well. And then we have a forensic team that goes out with us, and they triage the devices, and then they try to do an on-site exam if they can. If not, we have to bring it back to our forensic lab and let them do additional examinations on that devices.
How many cases at a given time are you, as one of the 19, I believe, folks who make up the ICAC unit, as an investigator, how many cases are you working on at a given time?
Right now, I have 21 cases on my caseload, I think. We're trying to reduce the number of cases that we have down to 10 to 15 cases because of the amount of paperwork involved, the amount of research that we have to do. We have to go out and do surveillance. And if we have an excessive number of cases, then it's hard to dedicate as much time as we need to each individual case. And so we try to limit the number of cases we have so that we can get those cases completed and move on to the next cases.
I see. How challenging is that, even to have 10 of this type of investigation all open at once?
It can be very challenging. Part of it depends on where in the investigation each case is. And so if you can time it correctly, where you send out a legal process and you wait for it to return, hopefully the next return on the next case will come back at a different time, so then you can space that out. Ideally, that would be how it works, so you can kind of keep flowing. And unfortunately, sometimes all those returns come back at the same time. We can't control what timing Facebook gives us a response back or Google gives a response back. And so if we get them all back at once, you can be very overwhelmed because you feel that you need to go through that data as soon as possible. In other instances, you may be waiting, and so then you have to figure out what else can you do while you're waiting for those returns to come back and get additional information.
And that's very much out of your hands, like you say. It's up to everybody else. And can you give us an idea of, from the moment that report first comes in to ICAC until in arrest is made and the prosecution, the case is handed off, I should say, to the prosecution, is there a typical amount of time that elapses between those two events?
It's not a quick process by any means. I would say it'd be closer to anywhere from 3 to 6 months would be a good investigation time limit. With quarantine and the impact that COVID has had on every company, those return times have increased, the wait time has increased, meaning I could wait 6 months for Snapchat to provide me a return to my legal document saying I need the content, whereas before we might have gotten that information back in 2 or 3 months. And so it's hard to judge now what time frame we might be getting stuff back to be able to move it on to the next stage. We hope to have it to prosecution within 6 months if we can, but we're finding that that time is increasing because of COVID.
So for the task at hand, we're here to talk about the training program that you have helped develop and get off the ground to essentially get more law enforcement folks across the state trained up on some of these specialized skills that it takes to take one of these investigations to the point of arrest and even prosecution. Give me a little of an idea of what that discussion was in the ICAC unit to say, hey, we have a tremendous need here. Mm-hmm. What can we do to maybe grow our resources to prosecute or to arrest more of these bad guys and lead to more prosecutions? What was that conversation like?
There were a couple things that happened around the same time when we talk about the training program. The first part is we'd had some interest in people, and by people I mean law enforcement officers, working some of these cases, but they didn't really know where to begin or how to do that. And so there was a discussion about how do we teach them how to work these cases and to assist in not only these cyber tips that we're getting from NCMEC, but also in the reports they're getting from citizens into their own agencies. And so we're teaching how we needed to come up with a plan on how to teach them to work those cases rather than relying on us to work them. The second part of that is we talked about increasing our staff and what that might look like to try and handle additional cases, meaning if we get another investigator, we could assign more cases and try and reduce that caseload that way. But we didn't have an internal training program to hire new investigators on for working these cases. So we're talking about the benefit of developing a training program for both of those concepts, training law enforcement outside throughout the state and also internal that we hired. And so the initial training program that was developed to teach them just how do you read those reports that come from NCMEC, and what information is contained within it, because they're not all reported in the same format. Facebook may report information in a different manner than Google or Snapchat does, and so developing a training program to help people understand what is in the reports was the first step. From that, we realized the need of teaching them, after you get the report, how do you work those cases? Or if you get a report from a civilian, how do you work that case once you get it? Because there's a lot of information there, and what is the most important steps to do first? So we talked about what that training program may look like, what information would be necessary, because we don't want to start with ground zero. I mean, we're training law enforcement officers that have experience being law enforcement, and so we don't need to teach them those basic steps, just particular to ICAC. And so we narrowed down topics that we felt were important in these investigations, and then we identified that those topics are also important in other types of cases, for example, domestic violence or stalking or even fraud cases, and the need that other agencies may see in that. So as we developed those topics, I formed a committee of other ICAC investigators that composed of our training, or our ICAC investigators with the Attorney General's office, but also our affiliate agencies. And so we have several trainers that have come together. We've developed the curriculum itself. It is a 3-day training program. And in the initial stages of that training program, we decided that we wanted this to be a free training for law enforcement and prosecutors. There are smaller agencies that just can't afford to send their officers to a training program that costs. And so if we offer it for free, then we're much more likely to get those smaller agencies that would need that additional training. So we're using our own resources, our own funding that we have, to cover the cost of the trainers and the materials, and obviously any additional follow-up that may need after the training. So we put this initial training program together with the intent of training one batch of class, essentially one class, in 2021. Once we started developing that training curriculum and we released the training registration for that, we started getting additional requests. And we went from having one training scheduled to having four trainings scheduled this year alone. It was such a need and such an interest across the entire state of Idaho. And then after we did a couple of the trainings, we started getting requests to train school resource officers specifically in ICAC cases that happen within the schools. And so we also have done two of those this year. So we went from having no training program to having two different types of training programs with multiple sessions already this year.
And we announced a Meridian training on July 20th. I'm looking here at our press release. This was one that was held in tandem with the Meridian Police Department, I believe it was at the—
Correct.
Yeah, their training center. You've also been in Nampa, Pocatello, and you're headed to Coeur d'Alene?
That is correct. We're heading to Coeur d'Alene later this month.
So September 14th through the 16th. I have the email address here. If someone in law enforcement in Northern Idaho is tuning into the podcast, can they still get registered, or their agency still get registered?
They would need to reach out to us first and kind of talk to us, but depending on how much more interest we have to limit some, but I might be able to accommodate one or two more people.
Okay. And perhaps before we wrap up, we can tell folks to get a pen and paper, and we can share your contact information or ICAC's contact information on how a law enforcement agency may get in touch. So let's back up. I want to talk about the curriculum specifically, but before we get there, as you mentioned, you know, you're training people who are already post-certified, they have a background in law enforcement investigations, they've been out in the real world working real cases. What is it that makes an ICAC case different, where there needs to be some supplemental training of these specialized skill sets that maybe the average investigator in the local police department doesn't have?
So there's several factors that we found, and we were kind of surprised as we built this curriculum out what we needed to include and what we didn't. And so the first part of it obviously deals with the internet. and how is information being transmitted. And so we had to talk about IP addresses or internet protocol addresses and how those impact the cases, and how do you find those IP addresses, meaning how do you find the information on what device or what subscriber, internet subscriber account was used to transmit. And so if you find the IP address that's related to the account, then what do you do with that? You have to figure out who owns that IP address. Is it Cable One or Verizon or Sprint or Charter or whoever else owns it? And then where do you send legal process to them to find out who is using their account at that date and that time? IP addresses can be assigned in a couple different manners. And so it's not, you can't just send a subpoena and say, give me all the information about this IP address, because it may not be the same today as it was yesterday for who's using it. Okay. And so we talk about how that looks and how to get the information and where to go. And we talk about what you need to send to those internet service providers to get that subscriber information back. We talk about search warrants and how do you get content from those accounts, and what information as far as case law is relevant to requesting those account information or the content of those accounts. Some of the other stuff is we talk about interviewing in ICAT cases.
Yeah, I wanted to ask specifically about that one. Why is that different?
In the training, we specifically tell them we're not teaching you how to interview. We're teaching you how to interview in these cases. So some of the specialty, I guess you would say, that we start out talking about is in a typical interview, you start out asking the person you're interviewing, what is your name, your date of birth, your address, your phone number, even maybe your email, typical contact information. In these types of cases, that information may actually be what led you to the person. Was the phone number on the account? Was the email address that they provide you the one that was related to the reported account containing child pornography? If so, and you ask that basic information and you don't Mirandize them, you could potentially come into a suppression hearing because you've now asked them potentially discriminating information without offering them Miranda, if Miranda applies in that situation.
Meaning the information that you got in that situation may not be able to be used in the prosecution.
That's absolutely correct.
Which really hampers the prosecution.
It does. Gotcha. So in a typical, like a domestic violence or a fraud or something like that, they may start the interview saying, give me all this contact information and who are you, basically. Whereas in our cases, we are teaching them more, get their name on the record, and then if Miranda applies in that situation, you need to do the Miranda warnings or the constitutional rights warning, and then you can ask those detailed information so that that information isn't suppressed later on. And so that's one of the other ways that this case or these cases are a little different. We talk about introducing evidence into these interviews. And so obviously we're talking about child pornography. We can't show child pornography to an offender to say, is this something that you remember sharing or possessing? And so we talk about how do you get them to confirm some of those images that are in the file if they're cooperative with you. We talk about information that's important, not just about did they possess and transmit child pornography, but kind of how did they get into doing this? Like, what led them to these steps, and what is their interest, and how long have they been in it? All of that is relevant information. And while it may not be relevant to did they possess or transmit, it's still relevant to the whole concept of the child pornography and how bad of a problem is it, or how recent of a problem is it.
We mentioned in our press release, you mentioned already in our conversation, that there's also an invitation to prosecutors. As folks may know, that you know, our office investigates, we facilitate an arrest in these, you know, some of these cases, and then at that point the case effectively leaves our office and is handed off to a prosecutor, the local county prosecutor. In a lot of cases, sometimes they are charged federally, and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Idaho prosecutes the cases. What is the training opportunity for prosecutors specifically that you've developed within this program?
So before I answer that question, I'm going to back up and mention something I didn't mention before. I mentioned that we have several trainers that are within our office and our affiliate agencies, but we also have attorneys that have helped us in this training program. And so the U.S. Attorney's Office actually has an attorney that attends each of these trainings, and then we invite a local state prosecutor to assist in training. We have a four-hour legal block that we have presented by that federal attorney and the local state attorney. And so those attorneys are ones that we work with closely that are familiar with ICAT cases, and they help the attendees understand some of the legal complications or issues within these cases specifically.
I see.
So then because we're doing that four-hour legal block within the training, we will send this training program out to other attorneys' offices and say, are you interested in attending? For the attorneys, we offer the opportunity for them to attend just that four-hour legal block so they can understand some of the issues that the officers are understanding, or we give them the opportunity to attend the entire three-day training. And we've had an interesting response to that, actually. Each of the attorneys that have signed up have requested to attend the entire three-day training because they want to understand why the officers are doing certain things or why they're not doing other things. And going through this training has helped them understand the investigative process so that they can then present it in court. So we've had, I believe, three prosecutors attend so far. And the training that we have coming up in Coeur d'Alene, I believe we have five signed up for that training. And
That's
so it's
great.
Been an interesting response from the prosecutors.
Good. Good. I want to ask about the dividends that this is paying. I recognize that it's brand new. Do you remember when you did the first training?
So we did NAMPA's training in May, I believe.
Okay. So we're 4 months into this entire process, which means you're actually clipping off about one a month, which is pretty impressive for a brand new.
It is.
Yeah. So kudos to you on that. But are you seeing benefits being paid at this point from the work that, and time that you've invested in the program and the training of other officers that have already been done across the state?
We are. As you mentioned, aren't very far into this training program. In each training program, we obviously give them contact information for us and for some of our partners in case they have a case that comes up and they need to understand how to work it. We're getting phone calls from people that have gone through the training saying, hey, I just got this case and I just want to make sure I'm not missing something from what I learned in the class. Or they'll say, I just got this case and I've done these things. What do I need to do next? And so we are getting calls that we wouldn't have gotten before, asking for assistance or just asking for additional resources. Hey, do you have a template on how to get content back from Kick or whoever? And so we'll share those resources back to people that have attended the class. Some of the other positives that have come out of this is we've had additional agencies, law enforcement agencies, such as police departments or sheriff's office, contact us asking if they can sign an agreement with us to maybe work some of our cases. And so once we get them on board, the sheriff or the chief has signed that agreement with our agency, then we can share additional resources with them, but then maybe we can also share some of that backlogged cases with them, assign them a cyber tip here or there to work alongside with their caseload.
I was going to ask, what is the ultimate goal? As you execute more trainings across the state, you share this specialized skill set that ICAC has within the unit with numerous other law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, but when will you lean back and exhale a little bit and, you know, sort of pump your fist and say, yeah, this was a success?
At this point, I think we can already see that it is a success. We've had such a tremendous request for this. We've already had requests to put on additional trainings next year. We've also had requests from other disciplines within law enforcement. So parole and probation has expressed a big interest in attending these classes. And so we've made the determination to develop a program specifically for them, because parole and probation doesn't conduct investigations, but this is relevant to the people they supervise. And so we're going to develop an additional program for them. And then, as you mentioned, we've gotten a request from school resource officers, and we've conducted two classes on that already. And we've had requests for additional trainings for school resource officers. So as far as the success, I think we can say now it has been a success. While there are things we've identified to improve in the future, we've discovered additional topics as well that they're requesting that we teach on. And so the development of that, and I see this being in the development stage for several years as we develop these various programs or topics that are of interest to law enforcement. As far as sitting back and kind of observing, I think that'll be a 3 or 4 year out because there's still all these different requests coming in. We're going to have to evaluate at some point how much can we effectively train each year and still work our cases.
I was going to say, because when I attended briefly the Meridian training 5 weeks ago or whatever it was, it looked like, you know, most of the ICAC unit was there, which obviously this is an investment in sort of, you know, future investigations, but that means that current investigations have to be put on hold for more than half of a work week to share these skills.
Yes. So each training, we will have between 4 to 6 ICAC trainers there. With it being a 3-day training, you don't want to hear the same 2 people talking for 3 days. And so we have to bring in different people within our agency or task force to present the information. And we try to rotate the trainers so that not every officer is pulled out of their case list for that long. So we'll have trainers from Eastern Idaho and Northern Idaho, and then obviously from Central Idaho here. But it still does take them out of the office anywhere from 3 to 5 days, depending on if we have to travel. And so we're hoping that if we can kind of get this a little more smoothly run, we might be able to reduce that down to 3 to 4 investigators so that others can keep working their cases. But you asked earlier about the ultimate goal. We're hoping that agencies will start working their own cases more often rather than contacting us and asking us to take their cases, which is historically what has happened. We've been contacted by an agency, hey, I have this ICAC-related case, will you guys take it? And we just don't have the capacity to do that. And so that is one of the goals, is to having them work their own cases and potentially having them work these cyber tip reports.
When these agencies send an individual to the training, does that individual then sort of become the designated person in that local agency to investigate these cases, or do they go back and then do some sort of, you know, interdepartment training to share the skill set that they picked up over the 3-day training with others in their same law enforcement agency?
So as far as having a designated person, if that agency wants to have a written agreement, an MOU with us, then the agency would determine who that person is. And it may be the person that already went through the training, or they may identify a different person to go through a future training and be that contact person. We do hope that they'll go back and share this information within their agency. We do give them copies of the PowerPoints, and we give them a thumb drive with resources and templates and information that they can then share with others. But it's so much information that they have to grasp and then try to relay to others. We're not sure how much of that is being relayed once they go back.
Okay. Did you model this after something else that exists somewhere else that's similar?
So we took some of the concepts from a training put on by Fox Valley, and it's called Investigative Techniques, and it's for ICAC training specifically. There are concepts that were taken out of it, but we did not go through and say, oh, I really like this, I'm going to take it. It was more, I looked at the agenda and I'm like, oh, that topic would fit within us. And then we developed our own PowerPoints within it. We chose not to ask Fox Valley to use theirs because we wanted this to be more Idaho geared.
And what's Fox Valley?
Fox Valley is a technical college, and they have a program within their college specifically for law enforcement.
Okay.
And so that is the program that we looked at their agenda, looked at the topics, and then we added a few topics of our own. One topic that we added that's not in theirs is mental health. We have a whole section on self-care and mental health within ICAC cases, because you have to take care of yourself because of the trauma that these images and videos can have on an individual if you have to look at them.
Yeah, and that's something we've talked about with your commander, Chris McCormick, before, and just the steps that are underway here in the Idaho ICAC, in the AG's office, to focus on that mental health, because that is certainly an integral component. You mentioned that after you've done several trainings that some of the feedback was to add certain topics that you had not identified. Is there something that you can hold up as an example of one of those that the attendee said, hey, could maybe next time we talk about this?
Sure. One of the topics, both in this three-day class and in the one that we've done for the school resource officers, they've asked repeatedly about the applications that these kids are using. What kind of apps are they using? What do they do with them? And so we've had the request to create trainings that talks about the most popular apps, whether it's Kick or Snapchat or Messenger or whatever. How are the kids using it? What can be done on those apps? And then they also want to know, if they submitted legal process, what could they expect to get back under that legal process? And so the complication or the challenge with that request of training is we would have to modify that almost every time, because the trends change so often. And sometimes even within the app itself, the abilities or capabilities may change, and how the kids are using it may change. And wow. So that would be something to have to be updated or modified for each training.
Okay, interesting. Tamara Pitts is a criminal investigator with the Idaho Internet Crimes Against Children Unit here in the Office of the Attorney General. Tamara, is there anything that you would like to add that I have not given you the chance to say before we wrap up here?
I can't think of anything other than we're very grateful for the response, and that in addition to teaching for ICAC, we do mention throughout the trainings on how law enforcement can use some of this information in their other cases. If there's a stalking case, we talk about how do you use the IP address information in a stalking case, perhaps, to help a successful prosecution or investigation in those manners. Or if it's a fraud case, how can they apply this to those cases? And so we try to make it not just an ICAC specific. We do focus on ICAC throughout the entire training, but then we'll mention you might be able to use it in this type of case as well.
The Coeur d'Alene training is September the 14th through the 16th. Is this the last one that you have on the calendar for 2021?
Correct. We won't have another one until next year.
And do you know where you're headed in Idaho next year at this point?
Not yet. We have determined that we're not going to go back to the same cities, just to give other agencies opportunities. So we've not identified where those next locations will be at.
But stay tuned, and we'll likely have some information. So those who may be hearing it who may want to get one of the last spots in Coeur d'Alene, what's the best way to reach out to ICAC to possibly get them in the door for the training on the 14th, 15th, and 16th?
The best way would be to email icactraining@ag.idaho.gov. So ICAC training@ag.idaho.gov.
Very good. Tamara Pitts, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate your work on this project and helping spread the word about some of the different type of work that is going on in ICAC. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, the ICAC training in Coeur d'Alene is coming up on September the 14th, 15th, and 16th. That email address once more, icactraining@ag.idaho.gov. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Counsel for the State.